Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Squawker Talker. Today, there seems to be an amazing amount of transfer activity happening. Perisic seems to be going to United. Bernardo Silva's already joined Man United. Thomas Tuchel has left Dortmund. Looks like he's being replaced by Lucien Favre. We thought in this climate of transfer and change in football, we'd re-upload one of our old pods, an interview with John Smith that I did back in September 2016. Mega agent. He was agent to Diego Maradona. He was one of the founding fathers of football agency as we know it, and he has some incredible tales about the game. So have a listen, and hope you enjoy. Thanks very much.
And I was there right at the start. I was fortunate enough to be in the room with Murdoch and David Dean and Irving Scott and all the people that started the Premier League, and we never believed it would be this successful, but once it started taking off, you could just see exponentially the rise and rise of prices, because the world, although it's a smaller place in terms of communication, has grown enormously, the ability to tap into the finances around the world. So we're now talking about a global market, which is actually still quite small by comparison to the oil market, say, or the market for steel around the world. But we are probably... outside of sex, the most interesting part of the entertainment of your life.
And in terms of, obviously, there's been some huge deals this summer, Pogba to Man United, and with that money, Juventus bought Higuain, you know, and with that, and probably a part of, you know, football which is often criticised or given negative coverage is the agency fees that come with that. I mean, I assume that they've skyrocketed as well, and it's now an extremely profitable living for those agents representing those players.
The very few, actually, the very few. Yes, let's kick that around a little bit. The last transfer window, a player that was probably 3 to 5 million last year was 10 million this summer. The 12 million player was 25 million, the 30 million pound player was 50 million this year. Now, it got a bit interesting because although that was driven, obviously, by the monies that Sky and BT and foreign sales had given to the football, to the Premier League, so that was an £8 billion broadcast deal, or broadcasting deals. The prices stayed high until the very end of the window. So the clubs were actually getting quite reluctant to spend some of that money because with it came inherently big wages, which I'm very happy to talk about, by the way, because we were part of in my mind, justifying the big wages is the amount of money that the guys earn, not for themselves, but for their employers and for the industry that surrounds them. But we can kick that around as well if you want. Essentially, towards the end of the window, the pound played a part, the pound being low against the euro and sucking in European players. And by about the transfer window ended on a Tuesday, Wednesday, this last year. By about Thursday, the week before, the prices in Europe were coming off because the English clubs were saying, hang on, we're just not doing that. And if you look at some of the expenditure, it's really at the top, apart from one or two scattered. Clubs like West Ham actually bought 13 players, but all around the £3 to £7-8 million mark. So there are ways of doing business, and you could predict what was going to happen. But the interesting thing for me is what happens next, because we've all seen the rise in this market, and everyone now is anticipating that the tech companies are going to be there in the next round, and the Googles and the Amazons, as because they did the Top Gear deal, for instance. Oh, well, they're going to buy football next, aren't they? I'm actually not so sure. So there's an anticipation of this £8 billion deal becoming a £10 billion deal in the next round. Now, there are players that haven't really entered the market big time yet. China to a degree, India certainly. So there will be rising factors. But I'm just adding a note of caution here that just maybe the tech companies will look at the market and they'll say, you know what, we don't need it. We've got the social, we've got the chatter, we've got the data we're collecting from millions and millions, tens and hundreds of millions of people around the world. We've got the advertising that goes with all that. Why do we need to spend 5, 6, 8 billion to go and get the rights, which we can feed off? So just a cautionary note, this may be a glass ceiling. I was listening to Raiola the other day on Jim White's new talk radio show, and he was talking about there'll be a £200 million player, and quite probably there will be, but I'm not sure it's tomorrow.
Okay. I mean, it's fascinating to hear about, you know, the amount of money in football from a very business point of view, which is obviously, you know, the world that you've approached it from for so many years. You mentioned players' salaries, and very often that's something that people find incredulous, you know, the £200,000 a week, £250,000 a week, whatever it might be. Do you think it's more a disconnect from a fan point of view in terms of they're paying such and such amount for their Sky subscription and their ticket to go to the games, for example, and the wages that they're seeing the players receive? They feel that there's a huge disconnect there. Do you think fans are priced out of the game somehow, in terms, especially when going to stadiums?
There are four questions in that question.
All right, I apologise.
No. It's actually very... I just want to break it out into three or four different parts. The first part is the fans, and I choose my words carefully here, remain the heartblood, but not the fundors of our sport anymore. So, in other words, what they pay for their Sky subscription, of course, is important, because without that money, there is no Sky. Mm. And what they pay for their turnstiles is important. But the deals are coming from broadcast who need it. Of course, they need the fans. They need to sell them back. Mm-hmm. But they're selling them around the world corporately too. So the fans are very important, because otherwise you have empty stadia. Mm-hmm. And that is not a product that's going to sell. So the fans are very important, but it is a team effort, literally, off of the field. So you need the broadcasters, you need the sponsors, you need the advertisers, you need the broadcasters, and we need you guys. You're as much part of the fabric of football as I am. You talk about wages. I don't have a problem with wages, because these guys are earning big money, but the earnings that they are generating are much, much bigger. The guys that we represent, or I used to represent, and the guys these days represent, have enabled there to be an £8 billion broadcast contract, or a five and a three from overseas, plus probably another billion from stuff. So why should, they're the guys doing it. Why shouldn't they be paid £100,000 a week if that's what the clubs value them at, to generate that money? But let me go inside the contracts for a moment. The likelihood of a player who is reported as earning £100,000 a week is that he's not on £100,000 a week. He's probably on 60 to 70. What happens then is there is then loyalty clauses, signing on fees, not so much benefits in kind in this country, but in very often in foreign countries, they use benefits in kind, which aren't taxed as heavily as benefit in kinds are taxed here.
Right.
And this is the one that I love. The bonuses that people like me have built into contracts, which are really very, very intricate. So not only do you get a win bonus, draw bonus, no bonus for losing, although sometimes you do. There are bonus contracts I've seen where even if they don't win, they still get a bonus for turning up, which I think is bizarre because that's what you pay them for. But anyway, put that aside. The bonuses are often construed, because it's a squad game and you've got three substitutions, if you're on the bench, which, you know, I'm not talking about the major stars now, because you buy them to play them. Although when they're injured, this sometimes kicks in. On the bench, off the bench in 45 minutes, off the bench before or after 60 minutes or 75 minutes, or appearance.
It's that detailed?
That detailed. And I actually
That's
tried...
That's astonishing.
Well, I'm going to go even further. So now when you follow your team, now look at your manager and ask yourself sometimes, not always, and maybe not often, but just ask yourself a question. Guys come on in the 61st minute. Is that a financial substitution, or is it a footballing, or both? Because don't forget, at 61, 62 minutes, if he's got a 60-minute clause in his contract, that entrance below 60 minutes, it's probably worth £30,000 to the player. Now, that's a lot of money.
You just made me question the entire existence of James Milner at Liverpool. That is astonishing. Is it the same for the players coming off?
Yes, if you play, you have to play a certain amount of minutes. And it also works to the extent of, if you've got a lad you really want to encourage and he's on a really incentivized contract, and he's trained really well that week and he hasn't made the squad because you've played a certain system that week to counter the system of the opposition. The 89th, 88th minute, sometimes the 90th minute, manager substitute. Now, it's always considered, oh, we're going to slow the game down. We're going to break the pattern of play. Mm. And sometimes it is that. But sometimes it's, okay, you've done really well this week, go on. On you go, son. Earn yourself 20 grand for a minute.
I'm a bit speechless about that. That's incredible.
That's what this book is all about. It's not all about that. It's about a lot of other things too. But it's about what really goes on in football. I'm not criticising it. Mm. I think it's great because it enables us to get... You know, when I grew up, I loved the Brazilian football. I loved Socrates, Zico, all those sort of players. I never had a chance to see them unless Brazil played at Wembley once every 4 years, if I was lucky. Now, we've got Pogba here. All right, we haven't got Messi... We haven't got Higuain, we haven't got Neymar. So there's a few where our type of football doesn't particularly suit what they want to play. Mm-hmm. Bit physical, a bit harsh sometimes. But we are getting the Pogbas and we are getting a raft of the major talent in world football that you and I have the privilege and pleasure to go and watch each other. I mean, look at some of the ball play you see. Look at the guys running in. You know, you play a cross-field ball onto an incoming player in a pitch that's concave. You can't even see the touchline. That kind of talent is immense. And by the way, the guy's running in from like 80 yards behind him. Yeah. You haven't known him run. You're anticipating the run because you play with him and you know how the game works. Mm-hmm. It's immense talent. And we watch that and kind of take it for granted. Go back to when I watched the game, my kiddie years, the 50s, 60s, 70s. It's physical. It was harsh. It was you know, kick and run, really, at a more senior level. So I think we pay for that privilege, and the ability to pay for that privilege is these sort of stories that I'm talking about in contracts. It's not negative. It's life.
Mm. I mean, obviously, it's taken a while to get to that point with contracts where such detail is being added into them, and obviously some players would work with their agent on those contracts and they have demands, etc. I mean, really? Wow. Maybe more widespread. I mean, is... Now it's a more widespread practice. I mean, obviously, you know that because you know other agents are doing it. I mean, how well do football agents work together? I mean, is it quite a cutthroat industry? Is it quite a pleasant industry between agents? Or
it's an interesting question. I mean, I started the Association of Football Agents, the AFA, which Mel Steen is currently chair of. And there are, since FIFA disbanded, FIFA used to, I was going to say, professionally oversee the agents. Well, they never did, really. They hadn't got a clue. Anyway, they decided they'd scrap it because it was too much, like, hard work. It's now on a system called intermediaries, and our local FA, there used to be, when there was a FIFA system, there used to be 400 agents in England alone. Mm. There are now 1,600 intermediaries.
Wow.
Now, my educated guess would be that 1,520 of them, 1,550 of them maybe, don't do that much other than turn up. And most of them are very professional because they try and act professionally. But they don't do very much. They may have a player or a friend who knows a player. The big boys, the WMGs, the Stellas and people like that, and Jonathan Barnett, all of us meet around the AFA boardroom table. We all work together. Sure, it's cutthroat. But, you know, the regulations are so diverse sometimes that you can't move players if you've moved them within a year. And you think, you know, the regulations are drawn up by people who don't quite understand what on earth's going on. And I'll tell you about another story in a minute, which will show you that.
All right.
So the agents sometimes get together and go, you know what, I'll do that move, you do the move behind me, and we'll split the fees. And people don't know that either. We just know what goes on because we talk to each other. The major agents talk to each other, and sometimes the local agents talk to the big guys because they've got the local area, you know, let's say Hull, I'm just using that as an example, where some guy particularly, you know, is friendly with two or three of the Hull players. Inevitably, they'll come to Hull with an agent. But if it's some young kids coming through, the big agents may, you know, work with a little guy, littler guy in that town. Let me just tell you something a second, which is a great example of how agents work other than what you and... Not just you, but a lot of people's view of agents is they have a player, they try and trade him every year, every 2 years, every 3 years. They earn some money from his Nike or Adidas deal. That's it. I mean, A, they're with them day and night these days. You really have to work your player, understand your player, love your player, be with your player, and the family. And very often, you'd go and try and sign a 16-year-old player that Arsenal are interested in as a kid today. The family may well say, yep, well, I've seen 16 other agents, what's it worth? Mm. And you have to write a cheque out for £60,000-£50,000 or put a mortgage in place for them or give the father a Rolex watch. You know, it's life. They've got a valuable asset they want to trade in.
Mm.
And there's zero security for the agent. They can only sign them for 2 years, which means if he's got a three-year deal, it may not come in your time. And also they have the ability to give you 1 month's notice and away you go. So, you know, there's no security in the agent world, which is why the big guys hold on to them. Because
right.
They put lawyers and accountants and commercial deals together, and they have a team of people managing their lifestyle.
But it's a counter to their interests, actually, to make them move every year, because that will make them unhappy and they are less likely to renew with that agent.
Well, I think the big guys don't need that movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, was Jonathan Barnett happy when Joe Hart left Man City? There was another move for him. Well, he probably wasn't unhappy for the commission he'd be earning. But, you know, for me, I think Jonathan's professional enough and his partner, David Manassi, to know that he's more valuable at Man City.
Mm.
I actually quite like the idea of the Bow players going abroad. I think, you know, the traffic coming in here,
mm-hmm.
it's nice to see our guys moving English football around the world too.
Yeah.
Let me go back to this little story I was going to tell you.
Sorry, yeah.
So there's a player in this last window who was subject of a 20-odd million pound offer from another English club, which didn't happen. They tried to get it to happen. They were, as I understood it, only 3 million apart. What happened in eventuality is that they couldn't engineer the move. The agents just couldn't cohesive it together. The selling club was just too stubborn. And normally you can move it, and sense and sensibility in some sense of the word prevails. So what they did is they looked at the regulations again, and it would appear, but it is reality, in fact, that because he's under 24, should he move abroad in January, which he can because he's in the last year of his contract, or he can give notice to go abroad, he's subject to compensation regulation rather than tribunal regulation.
Right.
So tribunal would say, well, this club's offered this is offered that the price is going to be budum that. And it won't be a million miles away from what they were talking about. However, compensation is £400,000. So they've got a club lined up for him for the summer in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
He'll go for £400,000. He'll ply his trade there, hopefully, because he's a good young player. He'll do well. The club in Europe will be very grateful for having picked him up for Thrupp's Halfpenny. We'll sell him back to England as soon as they can for 10, 15 million pounds. They would have made a sizable amount of money. The player will make a lot more money because he would have travelled twice and be subject to smaller transfer fees, therefore more money for him,
mm-hmm.
which is it works in inverse proportions to the guys at the very top who get big wages because the price is big.
Yeah.
He'll come back in a year or so's time, sign for one of the Premier League clubs probably, and the agents will earn about £5 million. And people will go, oh my God, £5 million? But they've earned that. They've earned that because the deals are so good and so big, and they've made people so much money. And if this was the financial services industry, you and I wouldn't bat an eyelid of the fact that their bank that they work for has lost £500 million and they're paying themselves bonuses of £2 million.
Mm.
But we can't get our heads around it in football, because football is our game.
Mm.
It's from the heart. It's tribal. It's our team. We don't want to give that bloke £5 million. That's our money.
Yeah.
Go back to the first question. Everybody's money in football.
The book actually starts off in the prologue with a fascinating story about a shady sounding character called Dimitri. I was wondering if you might be willing to share the tale, the background, and what exactly happened, because it's an amazing story.
Oh, I'm happy to share it. I'm not happy to tell you who Dimitri is.
All right, okay, that's fair enough. That's fair enough.
Because we changed his name. We were selling a football club. And we were invited to the Ukraine. We tried to meet in the UK. They didn't want to meet in the UK. We tried to meet neutral territory in Geneva. They wouldn't meet there. So three of us got on a plane. Roberto DeFanti, the Italian agent, who used to actually be director of football at Sunderland.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Story, who used to be at Portsmouth, and myself. And we arrived. And there was this guy that met us at the airport. He kept speaking like this, and he was bouncing up and down. And it was completely like on wire. And he must have been snorting some sugar stuff that they grow over there. But he kept going on about, this is really dangerous. This place is really dangerous. This was in the middle of the Ukraine crisis with the Russians. It's really dangerous. I'm going to keep your head down. And I'm like, okay, fine. I'm going to take you somewhere, but we can't take you to where we're going to do. I'll take you to the hotel first and then change, and we'll have to go out very, very quickly around the back way. And I'm like, okay, fine. Anyway, we get to the hotel, and there's gunshot everywhere. And we're like, what's going on here? And we see two people fall down in the street. They're obviously shot. And our drivers with the two huge henchmen sort of swing round and just dash off down this little side street, which is about as big as the smallest part of Brick Lane you can possibly imagine. And he must have done this 1,000 times before, because he doesn't hit the walls. And he's doing about 120 mile an hour.
Whoa.
And he's scooting off down here. We can't do this. We'll have to take you to a safe house. So anyway, long story short, we got taken to this safe house, which was dreadful, absolutely awful place. I mean, there wasn't even a glass of water in the fridge. It was like nothing there. And we were then afterwards escorted to a disused factory in the back of somewhere near Odessa. And it was really... And the guy who we met was very stern and very intimidating, really, and had a gun pointed at us during the entire conversation. Right, I mean, we had to sit down behind this desk, and he sat in the other side of the desk with a gun on the desk with his hand on it pointed at my stomach.
No.
And we're trying to be lighthearted and not to be intimidated. And even when I said, look, Dimitri, I'd appreciate, you know, just pointed at one of the other guys or something, you know, ha, 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 and not a crack, you know, nothing. Anyway, you know, it actually, the environment warmed up, and then we'd flown the owner of the club over as well, and they picked him up, and we went to this restaurant, which is shut down because of what was going on. They opened the restaurant up that night, and the talks went really very well. And then we were all invited to this big party with, it was just amazing. Again, it was in a disused factory with, you know, pools and slides going at the pool and dancing girls. And it was just the most amazing place. And we had a really good night. And we kind of shook hands on the deal. I wasn't quite sure whether it had been done. It was like 4 o'clock in the morning by the time we got out of there. And then the following morning, they took all our phones away from us as well, so we couldn't communicate with anybody.
Of course,
yeah. But they didn't take my iPad. And the following morning at about 7 o'clock in the morning, one of these big henchmen, a huge mountain of a man, burst into my room swearing profusely and saying, get up, one of the guys has been killed. Where's your phone? I said, you got it. No, you got something else. What have you switched on? And I'd been on my iPad that night. And I said, I got my iPad. And he, you know, was incredibly verbally violent to me. He said, get up, go to the boss now. And they took my iPad and they just screamed and shouted at us. And, you know, one of the guys got killed because the opposition had picked up my radio signals. And we were convinced we were going to be kidnapped. And it was just a really uncomfortable 24 hours. And they kept us in this like room with nothing, a really dark, dingy room. The owner of the club, they flew home. And it was really bizarre. And in the end, about 18 hours later, they came in and said, we've done a deal with the army. You're going to have to pay them to get out. And we had to give
them... With the army?
I don't know whether they did or didn't, but we had to pay some money to leave the country. And anyway, we left. The deal actually didn't happen, as you might have gathered.
Yeah, it sounds like it. There might have been a few...
Then we found out about a week or so later that a Swiss agent had been there and been killed. So I'm not quite sure what happened, but, you know, it's not worth... I'm a deal junkie. I'll go anywhere to do a deal, but it's not worth...
You must be a bit glad you're out of the game.
Yeah. No. I love it. And it's just that where there's a lot of money... I never quite figured out what that was all about, to be honest, because it never really... Although they did call us about 3 weeks later and said, look, we're coming to London. We want to do a deal now. And we're like, oh, yeah, okay. Well, I think we're a bit busy that week. And the funny thing is, when they were nice guys, they were such nice guys. I mean, they smothered us with love and affection and food and drink. And it was just really bizarre. Probably one of the most bizarre things I've ever experienced. And that's partly because the industry that we're in has become loaded with cash. And there are many interesting characters that have moved into Eastern Europe and beyond. So you're having to deal with not necessarily football people.
It does. It certainly sounds like there's some interesting characters in it. I mean, staying in the Eastern European version, you actually in region even you worked on the you were involved in the Andrei Arshavin deal, which is we had deadline day recently. It was notorious as this deal, which sort of did it happen on time? Did not happen on time? I was wondering if you could tell us what sort of happened with that deal.
It was I think a seminal moment on deadline day. I'll try and make it really short. So Arshavin had been going on since November, I think, and the Russians were always at a figure, I think it was 15 million quid, and Arsenal were at 8 at one point, and then we were at 10, and long story short, anyway, we got up to the last 48 hours, and we're still apart, and we've tried everything, we've tried using image rights, we've tried Arsenal, have offered them a game at their choosing at a time when it works with the calendar, which is another £500,000 worth of gate money, whether, you know, just like a pre-season game, like an Emirates tournament, something like that. And they wouldn't move. And it was interesting that Zenit in particular, I was dealing with a guy called Mitrofanov, who was the CEO. He reported up to a guy called Alexei Miller, who was the chief executive at the time of Gazprom. And I think the previous month he'd cut the gas supply off to the Ukraine. So he was like that level.
Charming fella.
He was actually very charming when I met him. A bit stoical, but very charming.
Yeah.
So he's doing a football deal this month and doing gas supplies last month.
Yeah.
And Alexei Miller, for all the power and strength he had, actually it was Putin's club. So because the club he supported, I believe, as a boy. So we were always aware that we were at a level. So when we couldn't break down anything anywhere, I popped a call through to David Dean, who was very friendly with Alexei Usmanov.
Mm-hmm.
Alisha Usmanov, sorry. And Usmanov tried to help us to move the situation around. And we got quite close. We now got a day left. And I'm talking to my brother Phil, and we're saying, you know, we'd managed to get him out of Russia into Paris. We didn't want to fly him into London because the Russians, although they kind of knew what we were doing, we didn't want to upset them.
Mm-hmm.
And them thinking, they're working behind our backs, the last thing we wanted. So we said to Andre, look, take a plane, go to Paris and just sit there, you know, have a nice Parisian dinner, and we'll be back in touch in a minute.
Yeah.
And then we looked at the weather forecast, and it was going to snow heavily the next day. And we're sitting there, we're going, listen, we just got to bring him in. We've got to have him here because he'll need a medical, B, he'll need to sign the papers. And in those days, 2009, it had to be physical signing. You couldn't do it by email. We flew him in, and we said, I took him to my house. I said, don't be seen, just keep your head down because, you know, we don't want to upset Russian people that you're here. And my brother had an arrangement at the Village Hotel in Elstree, so we parked him there. And the next day, I opened the papers, and I've got pictures of Arshavin everywhere. He'd gone outside to look at the snow.
Oh, God.
And, of course, everyone doesn't quite happen like that in Russia. So now we're thinking, oh, all bets are off. And then we caught a bit of a break. The transfer window got extended by a day. We were sort of closing the gap, but we were still £1.2 million apart. And the Russians were saying to me, okay, well, you'll have our answer at... We've got a meeting tomorrow. You'll have our answer at 3 o'clock our time, which was 2 hours before the window went. And I said to, you know, Mitrofanov, that's a bit tight. He said, well, that's it. That's it. So I thought, well, they'll move a bit and then we'll maneuver. And somehow we'll find a way of covering it off. Anyway, 3 o'clock comes and they decided that they weren't going to send him unless they got the whole asking price and a bit more, because they wanted some money that apparently he owed them. So we spoke to Andre and he said, oh, no, I'll pay the money that I owed them. I thought they'd wipe it off, but yeah, I'll pay that. So
right, okay.
So now we're back to 1.2 million. And the clock's now ticking and we're down to the last hour, and I'm talking to Ivan Gazidis, who's just arrived. This was his first day, I think, in the office at Arsenal. And I've got the Russians talking to me, and I'm at home because I can't move because of the snow. And my boys, my two kids, Russ and Scott, actually, they're not kids now, my two grown men children, are sitting in the next room, and I can hear Jim White saying, and Arshavin's in the country, and he's about to meet Arsene and shake hands on a deal, and I've got my head in my hands going, it's nowhere near that. With about, I think we had minutes left. We're looking at the last 15 minutes or so. And I phoned a guy called Pavel Palashenko, who was sitting alongside Mitrofanov, and I said, you know what? The answer's yes, 15 million, deal done. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have to pay this. But I will. I'll pay the 1.2 million.
So you stumped up for the 1.2 million?
We said that we would pay the 1.2 million because I thought, well, I'll get a chunk of it back from the commission, and we'll have him in the country, and it'll all... Anyway, I then phoned Ivan. I said, okay, I think it's done. And he said, how much did it cost me? I said, it cost 1.2 million. Oh. Okay. All right. Okay. And I'm thinking, does that mean he's paying it or am I paying it? Anyway, it didn't matter at the time because the clock was, we're now at about 15 to 20 seconds from the end of the window. Uh-huh. And I've got Pavel on the other, and I said, okay, Pavel, you have to, these days it had to be in writing. I said, fax Arsenal now with a paper that just says, because you've got all the papers there ready to go, just fax it in now. He'll sign it, send it back. We've got, you know, a minute left, 20 seconds, whatever the time was. I've written it in the book. I think it was about 20 seconds we were doing this. Uh-huh. And it must have been a bit more because we got to 20 seconds. It must have been about a minute and change before we... And the Russian fax machine wasn't working.
Oh, God, no.
So we're now saying... Everything
possible
was going wrong. And I'm thinking, there's no other way. We've got to use electronic mail. We've got to go to email. So I said, Ivan, please just email that you've agreed what, 15 million for Andrei Arshavin. Bang, done. Email gone. I can hear it in Russia about 10, 15 seconds later. It goes, bing. So I know that they've got it. I said, just... And we're now... 15, 20 seconds away from it. I'm shouting at Pavel, just type in agreed in English. Agreed, full stop, on your email. It comes in with 4 seconds. Four seconds left.
James Bond
stuff. I can watch
stuff.
The clock ticking down. And as it comes in and I see this thing, I go, yes, and I can hear bong, bong.
The from bells, the TV.
From the bells of... the bells of Big Ben.
So you just needed the written agreement.
Well, actually, we had to wait 24 hours then because that was the first time that we'd actually done it by electronic mail.
Really?
Because they needed physical paper. And I just said, look, I made a big case to the FA the next day. I said, the machine didn't work. They're in Russia, we're in England, and the machine did not work. So at least we've got electronic mail. And that was the opening of the system. I think Van der Valk got very close to that situation as well. And because of these two, they put in an electronic matching system now where you can go bing, bing, both sides. And actually, that system fell down on the De Gea deal because the bing, bings, bong, bonged, and the bing, bings didn't match the bong, bongs, and that's where the deal fell down.
So that deal was completely on, and there was a technical failure.
Yeah, but no one could, with the amount of time that was passing away, nobody could quite get to grips with why it went wrong. You know, I wasn't there, so I don't know. I would have thought a telephone would have helped. But you know, but obviously,
you think so.
There was probably something a bit more fundamental to it.
So after that, it was just Real Madrid and Man United posturing, effectively.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that was probably the way it is. It's, you know, you don't want to really admit to your supporters that you didn't stump up the cash, or you didn't quite make the cut, or you didn't quite get the communication right.
Yeah.
Somebody goofed somewhere, or someone got cold feet somewhere.
Yeah. Who ended up paying the 1.2 million?
They did, actually.
No way.
Then I got my commission. I was happy to do it though.
I mean,
it was you know, I wanted him here.
I got one more question to ask, and I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier to a certain degree. And I think a lot of the theme of the book, which is sort of almost, you know, talking quite frankly about the industry, and sort of it addresses some of the preconceptions that fans might have about agents. Why do you think that fans have such a negative perception of football agents?
Largely, I mean, I'm a fan of the media, but largely because of the media. If the media had said, oh, agents are really good for the game from the get-go, people would go, oh, maybe they're okay. But, you know, the media influences to a degree who we vote for Prime Minister, whether we vote to stay in and out of Europe, and who will be the next England manager.
Mm.
So agents have always been positioned as the bad guys, and that reputation has just grown as the money's got bigger, you know. Mm. Estate agents are positioned as bad guys. And yet, entertainment agents are positioned as the good guys, the sort of glamorous guys that you know, hobnob with the stars out of Hollywood and do a great job for their artiste. But we are the bad guys. And I guess part of it is that we trade in human flesh. Touch of, you know, not exactly slavery for these sort of monies that are passing hands, but it's that kind of illicit, not quite kosher trade of, you know, I'm taking you and I'm transferring you and I'm getting a bundle of cash for it. And it's probably me that's wound up everyone to make that happen. And, you know, what do we give back to the game? And actually, quite a few of us give a lot back in terms of charity. And I would argue that guys, I would say this, wouldn't I? But guys like myself during the 90s and the 2000s up to now have sizably helped make the Premier League the success it has by being the guys that brought them. And I brought in Freddie Ljungberg and Ruud Gullit and Franco Zola and all those sort of people. And I think by having them here, we change the dimension of our game. You know, by having Arsene Wenger as a manager, we had food regimes, which we never had before. We had by adding the continental flair together with the English bite in our game, we've created the best, so this or during this chat we've had, the best entertainment, I think, on this planet. And that's something I'm very proud of, and I think agents should be. We're fighting at the Agents Association at the moment to have a seat at the table. We think we should be on the FA Council with everybody else. You know, the county associations are there. You get, and I like the guy, you get someone like Tony Kleanthos, who's the chairman of Barnet, sitting on some of the highest governing committees in global football out of England. Mm. Why? I mean, he's a nice guy, and I like him, and I really like going to see Barnet play sometimes. But what does he know compared to what we know about global football? And the fact that I can pick up a phone to the head of FIFA, and I can pick up a phone to the head of the Argentine FA, or the Japanese FA, or Real Madrid, the president of Real Madrid, or whatever, and they'll take my call because they think I might have something interesting to say, and they value, I think, I hope, the knowledge which I've gathered over 30 years. And yet, if I go in as an agent, I know I've sold my business, I mean, but if I wanted to go and, you know, do this all over again, and I do advise a lot of the agents now as well, and I sit on the board of directors of the AFA, if I go to the FA as I am doing now and saying, hello, you know, with all this experience we've got and the fact that we are, in inverted commas, in charge of a lot of the money that goes around your product, i.e. your players, can we sit and have a chat about that, please, at your official gatherings? And they go, no. And we go, why? Because you're an agent. Can we have a better excuse than that? Nope. So we've got a battle or two to have yet. A few people in the FA are beginning to look at us and go, you know what? They should have that position. You know, we do as much for the players as the PFA do, really. The PFA would argue that because the PFA look after everybody. Mm. And the PFA do a good job. Then sizably, the top 10 agents do a great job too. Mm. We should be there. We should have that voice.
The book is called The Deal. It's on Little Brown Publishing. It is available today for our order on Amazon. John Smith, thank you so much for your time. The book is an absolute must-read for any football fan. If some of the stories you've told us today and some of the insights you can give us don't convince them, then I think they're absolutely mad. Thank you so much for your time, and speak to you soon. Apart from that, subscribe to us on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, and we'll see you very soon. Bye-bye.